Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And happy Columbus Day. So I usually don't get a chance to kind of focus on the particular day of the week or significance of the day or so forth. And so what I've done before, and I want to share this with you again, is we're going to cover a excerpt out of Christopher Columbus's journal so that we can kind of lay waste to the false assertions of Christopher Columbus's intent. Because there's just way too many people that are trying to pervert our history, and they've gotten away with perverting our Constitution, our form of government. As we keep on getting indoctrinated, we're being trained to become the people that they want us to be. So before we get into Christopher Columbus and then possibly some need-to-know news, what I do want to do is I want to kind of cover the obligatories, which is it's now or never, the debt is fraud, and do not hesitate to exercise the power of prayer by getting involved with a prayer group. If you're looking for a prayer group, just let me know. Just send us an email, and there's a daily prayer that is occurring for those, you know, a prayer for those who are taking the step in reclaiming the Republic. Kind of more of a generic, but anyway, we need to start engaging with every potential, I'll just say, tool that will help us succeed. So before I get into Christopher Columbus and Columbus Day, there's a really, really good book that I'd recommend. And the name of that book is A Patriot's History of the United States. And this book was written by two professors, Larry Schweikert and Michael Allen. So I would highly recommend you get this. It's a long read, but they dive into how they actually challenge the narrative of millions of people dying and so forth. They actually get into what was the real number, because there wasn't millions of people living here at one point in time, at least back in those days. And that was just because they were such warring people. They killed each other all the time. And so when you dive into this book, they really go through the extent and length that they tried to get to some accurate numbers. And then they basically, out of all of the numbers, they recognize that, you know, you couldn't trust any of them. And so they kind of give you an estimate of, you know, what the real death toll in the Americas were from Europeans coming here, in contrast to the death toll in Europe from the Europeans bringing back natives from here. And, you know, the Europeans coming here, because, you know, there's always these different viruses, bacteria, and so forth that you're just, that's why when you travel abroad, you need to be heavily inoculated for all these different types of things. So when you travel, you need to go and get all of your vaccines and all that stuff for the area you're going into. But anyway, what I want to do, and I want to see, this is something that actually came out of his journal. This is the Christopher Columbus's journal from his first voyage and first contact. And so this is literally just me reading out of this. And it says, so many of the islanders gathered around us, I could see that they were people who would be more easily converted to the holy faith by love than by coercion. And wishing them to look upon us in friendship, I gave some of them red bonnets and glass beads, which they hung around their necks, and many other things of small value, at which they were so delighted and so eager to please us, we could not believe it. Later, they swam out to the boats to bring us parrots and balls of cotton thread and darts and many other things, exchanging them for objects such as the glass beads and hawk belts They took anything and gave willingly whatever they had. However, they appeared to me to be very poor in all respects. They go about as naked as they were the day they were born, even the women. They carry no weapons and are ignorant of them. When I showed them some of the swords, they took them by the blades and cut themselves. I believe they would have readily become Christians. It appears to me that they have no religion with God's will, or I will take six of them with me for your majesty when I leave this place. And he actually took some of them. And so anyway, I'll keep going. I kept my eyes open and tried to find out if there was any gold, and I saw that they had some of them had a little piece here hanging from from a hole in their nose. I gathered their signs that if one goes south, there is a king with a great jar full of it, enormous amounts. I tried to persuade them to go there, but I saw that the idea was not to their liking. The gold they wear hanging around their noses is from the island, but so as not to waste time, I wished to set off to see if I could reach the island of Cipango. Sunday, 14 October, 1492, whatever, I forget the year. Anyway, I gave orders at daybreak for a small boat of the Santa Maria and the boats of two caravels to get ready and went along the coast of the northeast to examine the eastward part of the island. The people were coming down to the beach. Some brought us water, some food. Others, seeing that I did not wish to go ashore, swam out to us, and we understood them to be asking if we had come from heaven. Just want you to understand, they wanted to know if these people had come from heaven, from the gods. These people have little knowledge of fighting, as your majesties will see from the seven I have had captured to take away with us so as to teach them our language and return them, unless your majesty's orders are that they shall be taken to Spain or held captive on the island itself for 50 men. One could keep the whole population in subjugation and make them do whatever one wanted. Now, he's just making an observation here, right? The islands are very green, lush, with sweet breezes, and there may be many things here which I do not know about, because rather than lingering, I wish to explore and investigate many islands in search of gold. So he was obviously searching for gold, but he was obviously trying to create a direct relationship with these people that they finally met, and actually trying to teach them their language so that then they would actually be able to translate from the native language to theirs. It was really an exploration. It wasn't necessarily a colonization, but to be clear, he's pointing out that they don't have a religion, and a part of Christianity, right, wrong, or indifferent, just like most other faiths, Islam and so forth, and even godlessness is a religion that tries to pursue and convince people that they, you know, need to become a part of, and or that they need to, convert and what have you. So anyway, the real point in bringing this up is that, you know, he didn't come here. Well, first off, he thought he was in India because they were looking to try to get there, but he wasn't seeing anything that he was expecting, and I'm not sure if he ever set sail to India, because he realized that these were westward or eastward islands of India, or at least so he thought. So he thought maybe these folks were of different type, or of a different language or what have you. So when we look at what Christopher Columbus did, he basically took the leap for those Mediterranean states to actually, and that Western society, because you got to remember, even though Leif Erikson had been here, they just didn't see the need or the desire. And if you really look at where natives, or I should say indigenous people in the North American continent were, they were really much further south. And so when Leif Erikson kind of saw that, you know, there wasn't a compelling need to try to create these colonies. I think they actually did try to create an outpost, colony, what have you, up in North, or actually in Greenland, or maybe it was in Iceland. But nevertheless, they never came down far enough and far south enough to where they actually started experiencing the tropical. At least there's no record that I've seen of that. Now, exploring and heading out and going into these different spaces in the world when it was all new, that was kind of critical. And I say it was kind of critical because we were getting to a point, or I should say society gets to a point where they're seeking to start making exchanges and start being able to share market space so that they can sell and buy and trade and do those types of things. Because obviously there's, you know, different products that are going to be made. And this is one of the things that was recognized in the European, or I should say in Western society, that as they started expanding, they were discovering, just like what the Egyptians discovered, just like what the Romans discovered, is that, you know, the world is rich with all sorts of things that, you know, aren't available from where you are. The interesting thing, and I don't remember if Alan Schweikert and Larry and Alan, these two historians I told you about, I'm not sure if they actually accounted for China, because China was recorded as a nation that was not interested in colonizing and or sharing. As a matter of fact, there was really no record of them setting sail until much later, after Western society connected with them several times. They weren't interested in even discovering any parts of the world because they felt that they had everything that they needed. They felt that they were a superior race. Interesting. I want you to understand this. They thought that they were a superior race, and they still do. And as a matter of fact, there's many races that truly believe they're a superior race. And as a matter of fact, when you kind of look at the different, I'll just say, empires of the world, didn't Egyptians think that they were the superior race? And didn't the Romans feel like they were the superior race? And so forth and so on. So China, even though they were never an empire of the world at that point in time, they already felt that they were superior. Now, there had been many cases, and as a matter of fact, one of the things I'll point out, in it was J.M. Roberts' book on the history of the world, he points out some of the parallels between the Middle Eastern society, or I should say actually Israel and Judea, and the North American natives, because apparently both of these people had their folklore, or they had this innate teaching that they were the chosen people. Isn't that interesting? So anyway, let me just leave it there. If you want to actually read an interesting book by a godless person, but it, in an academic sense, J.M. Roberts' History of the World is actually a decent read. And as you read it, just keep in mind that this guy is looking from a lens that is, you know, godless, where he's just basically pointing out all of the foolish things that people have done over the course of mankind, or over the annals and histories of mankind. And so when we look at the Egyptian Empire, he starts exposing some things that they thought. And as because he was not very literate on the Bible, some of the things he reported were very significant confirmations of the Bible. And so it's kind of interesting how these people go down this path of, you know, I don't need to know these silly things, these silly allegories of the Bible. All I need to know is, you know, what I know already, and I'm not interested in learning new tricks. And, you know, that actually is an adage that speaks volumes for most people as they get older. So I guess stereotypes, there's a purpose, there's a meaning, there's a reason why we have them. Anyway, so what we're going to do probably this Friday is I'm going to have hopefully an interview with either Chip Murray, who I played some music before. Maybe I should play some music again. But I played some music of Chip Murray. He has, I think, a couple of CDs. And they're all patriotic. They're all Christian. They're all... It's good music. And I would encourage you, if you're looking to listen to good music, and it's kind of like when I listen to his album, or, you know, I forget the name of the album, forgive me, but, and forgive me, Chip, for having such a scattered brain for not keeping names and stuff so well, but bottom line, when I listen to albums, usually, you know, most albums that are out there, they have a couple of good songs, and then the rest is just like filling up space. When I listened to his album, I actually enjoyed every song. There was always a good message, and the melody was, you know, reasonably, you know, I'll just say harmonious, or was pleasing, because, you know, as you get into it, there's, as I listen to things, I can always think of the other ways and other orchestrations of the music and so forth, but, you know, that's just the way I look at it. But I also look at the music on the artist's perspective, because usually how they lay out and orchestrate their music is what they're trying to convey. And so anyway, I would encourage you, if you're looking to get into some new music, because I'm telling you, the race, or I should say not the race, the generations of today, the past couple of generations, they have really been constrained from having good music. I mean, it's unfortunate that, you know, music has gotten so debased, and it's just, it's not, there's very little talent. I mean, why is it that, you know, guitar players of the world, there were so many great guitar players back in the 60s, 70s, and then there's very few that started rising up in the 80s, and less in the 90s, and less and less and less. Why is it that we're seeing musicianship and those types of skills going away? Ah, because you don't need to do all of that. You can just electronically do it. We can synthesize it. It's the same thing as you don't need a person to work in the bowling alley to actually put the pins up and to get the ball back to the bowler, because we automate it, because we're getting machines to do it. We got drum machines. We've got all sorts of music machines, or the generation of music, to where we don't need to, you know, have people engaged, which is one of the reasons why we're losing the raw, or I should say this refined talent as well as the raw talent. But anyway, we do have one more thing that's really important, is we do have, or it's in process. We're actually putting together, and we've got a good view of what we need to do to update the geoengineering. And I say this all in line with what we talked about on Friday. We talked a lot about geoengineering and how we're at a place where this geoengineering is literally trying to kill us. Because when we talk about the control of weather and the creation of storms, the lingering of rain and storms, and what they have been doing, that is doing property damage. It's the same thing with dews, the direct energy weapons, starting fires, and those types of things. Why is our government doing this? And if it's, you know, because they're trying to blame nature. Oh, this is all nature happening. This has never been seen before. And it's coming out more and more that people, it's becoming common knowledge, just like chemtrails. A week ago, I know I ranted on chemtrails. You know, it's when we talk about how the progressives and the dismissers, the deniers, and actually they're not deniers. Most of these people have been indoctrinated, so they just don't know any better. But most of the people that actually say, oh, those aren't chemtrails, that's just contrails, they are basically trying to maintain a narrative to suppress the truth. And so, as I said last Monday, it's not like, you know, they have the ability to defy physics, where a contrail will actually just dissipate normally, and then all of a sudden they change the physics in the atmosphere, and that contrail takes on a whole new life and creates this cloud formation all along the contrail until they change the physics of the air, you know, the atmosphere again, and it goes back to a regular contrail. I mean, that's what has to happen, because they're denying that those are chemtrails. They're denying that they're spraying anything in our atmosphere. Well, so in the geoengineering petition, we dealt with the chemtrails. We dealt with the CO2 pipeline. But we didn't add the dew weapons. We didn't add the weather control and those types of things. So that's what we're going to end up doing, because when you really look at it, and I think we mentioned this idea of using plant life, such as ethanol, to be added to fuel so that we don't use up so much of the rare oil, which we have more than an abundance of oil to suppress, or actually to exceed the need for the current generations living. We have that much oil under our feet. The question is, do we really want to continue spending the resources, the time? I know we're getting better at it, but there are ways and mechanisms that we could actually be doing better, and we wouldn't have to worry about the environment so much. But the reason why, and I'm not talking about electrical cars. I think electrical cars are crap. I'm talking about combustion engines. Combustion engines is a far more efficient way to go. So when we look at the alternatives, we can talk about that later. But the reality is they want to push you into a specific form of transportation so that they can control you. But more importantly, they've got to kill a lot of us, which is why they're doing what they're doing regarding the weather storms and so forth. So let me dive into, before we go into break, we got about 2 minutes. Let me dive into G. Edward Griffin, because I mentioned G. Edward Griffin's website, needtoknow.news. If you go to his Need to Know News, you'll actually find him exposing really good information. So what I've got is their headlines, and then he has kind of like a summary in the yellow paragraph, or the yellow caption, and then below that he has the details where he kind of go in the long version of the story. So this is really kind of the editorial view, or the summation of each of these different stories that I just selected for you. But these are actually hand-picked because they actually go hand in hand with these things that we've been talking about. Why do I do this? Because this is marketing. In other words, as I provide you the information, and we're going to cite people and things, because that's what G. Edward Griffin does. So as we provide this, my belief is that this will help motivate you, because it's not just GR saying something. There are actually news agencies out there that are really working to try to legitimately give you the truth of what the heck is going on. So we have a few weather, we have a COVID update and so forth. So let's dive into, actually I've got half a minute left. So the title we're going to get into is, it's must see, evidence that government can control the weather, including hurricanes. And so as we get into this, he's going to give you a little of the history of when they started playing around with this. And you know, when you think about it, we were really leading in the world on trying to understand and control things. I mean, so we're at a point now, because of the way we can control the weather throughout the world, we could really throw typhoon after typhoon after typhoon onto China and just devastate them. When you can control the weather, you have that ability. When we come back, we'll dive into this story. So please stay tuned, and we'll get into the evidence that he's going to expose regarding hurricanes and the weather. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get into this story. Evidence that the governments can control the weather, including hurricanes. Now, I believe G. Edward Griffin provides the summation, so these are kind of his words, as he kind of re-reports what the news journalist is providing. Alex Jones provides video, news articles, and government documents that show that the U.S. government can control the weather. Now, we already provided some of this information last week. The Stanford Research Certification in the late 1960s shows that the Pentagon, in association with the Department of Energy, can completely control hurricanes and can create, strengthen, steer, weaken, or even kill them. Jones said that Biden and Harris are in control of recent hurricanes. By 1965, the U.S. government had secretly certified that they had total control over hurricanes and typhoons. By 1967, the Pentagon certified and confirmed it. In 2015, then CIA Director John Brennan, remember Brennan, the scoundrel that was working in Obama administration, admitted to the U.S. government secretly using geoengineering via aerosol spraying to combat phony global warming. Bill Gates, who advocates policies to combat climate change, owns a patent on weather manipulation for hurricane prevention. Jones said that Ben Levingston, the, quote, admitted father of the weather weapons, close quote, was a meteorological engineer and pilot for the U.S. government who led weather control operations in World War II up through the 1990s when he commanded the Air Force in weather manipulation. He was the first person to fly into a typhoon and see the clouds. Other governments are using weather manipulation. In 1977, the U.S. signed a weather manipulation treaty through the United Nations. Weather manipulation can benefit some regions at the expense of other regions. Now, people are wondering why we've seen such chaotic weather. Why was, I think, Dubai and some of the Middle Eastern states, They got, as if I remember correctly, and somebody will probably remind me or actually correct me, but I believe Dubai received a level of rainfall that would basically account to the total rainfall they usually get over a course of decades. I don't know what the actual year is, like 30 years or something like that. They got all of that rainfall in one day, where they literally had a river going through the valleys of sand and so forth. So when we see what they can do and you understand the damage and the havoc, I mean, look at what's happened in America through these last two hurricanes. Are you going to tell me that that doesn't create havoc? It doesn't cause damage? How many people died? And then the people that are being basically manipulated for the government to come in and say, you can't have your land anymore. Let me just stop right here. remember this, that we have a petition and a series of petitions to prove that the government should have no ability, no authority, and should not be able to exercise these powers. These powers, this authority is not delegated to them in the Constitution. Over energy, over the environment, over the weather, it doesn't matter. They are there to serve the states. They are here to basically ensure that the sovereignty of the Union and the sovereignty of the states is being maintained. So I will go as far as when I stated in my first book that the United States government became the godless secular church, or what we would call the Antichrist church. They established it without even building, you know, a church, without building a steeple, without appointing a pope. They already have the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court are the ones that are going to maintain the godlessness in America by law. So when we look at the fact that they created the Antichrist church over the course of the past century plus, it's not too much of a stretch to look and say, you know, and this is where I just recently started realizing, because when I read Revelations, when I read the Bible, you know, we know that God has these powers. We know that God can do these things. And so when we looked at Revelations and we saw that how, you know, we saw, or you can read that in the last days, these storms and this, you know, unpredictable weather would actually, you know, descend upon us, killing people and so forth. I was under the impression that that was actually to be done by the hand of God. It doesn't say that. And so now I'm starting to realize that these are the signs that when man actually starts exercising this power over weather, and we start seeing and this wreaking of havoc and people dying. Let's look at it this way. They claimed that they had the ability way back when, in the 60s. Now let's talk about tornadoes. Let's talk about the damage that has happened from the hurricanes, tornadoes, and these weather events in the United States. These were just exercises, folks. Every time when the government, or I should say the military, goes out to, you know, practice an invasion with, you know, Iran or what have you, right? When they do these exercises, they do this to kind of prove that they can do this and how efficient they are and where do they need to improve? What do they need to do next time to be better in executing that? That's what we're seeing in these weather systems and these weather events. They've been practicing and practicing on us for years. There's no doubt in my mind, as we start looking at the patents and some of these documents that are being provided, I'm going, well, this kind of helps everybody, or at least it helps me understand, that what we're seeing are those signs, are those things that we're being warned about, that these are the type of events that you're going to see. So let me just go into this, because this is the next one. Conspiracy revealed government and NGOs flooded small American town with 2,000 Haitian migrants. Now, we talked about Springfield. This is a smaller category or a smaller scenario that has happened, and I want to go over this. This is a Charleroi, Pennsylvania, and I probably pronounced that wrong. It's Charleroi, and it's Pennsylvania, is a small blue-collar town with 4,000 residents that rely on factory jobs. The Biden-Harris administration brought in as many as 25,000 migrants from Haiti over a short period of time. The migrants compete for jobs while several plants are shutting down. Investigative journalist Christopher Rufo discovered, quote, an open conspiracy, close quote, between government and NGOs and companies that benefit from cheap labor. The White House has admitted more than 2,100 2,100,000. Is that right? No, it's 210,000. There you go. 210,000 Haitians through its controversial humanitarian parole program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, CHNV. So they are doing this, and the NGOs, or the non-government organizations, non-governmental organizations, provide migrants with resources to assist in travel, housing, income, welfare, medical care, and work. Oh, by the way, we're paying for this. The Jewish Family and Community Services, JFCS, Pittsburgh, is the most active resettlement NGO in Charleroi. Now, I know there's a lot of people that are just eating this up. Anyway, in 2023, the Jewish Family and Conservative Services, Pittsburgh, reported $12.5 million in revenue, of which $6.15 million came directly from tax-funded government grants. So in other words, half the money they received came from grants, not from donations or anything else. Much of the remaining funding came from other nonprofits that also get federal funds, such as $2.8 million from its parent organization, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Now, let me finish this and then we'll dive into it. Note that the Alejandro Mayorkas, the current head of Homeland Security that oversees the borders, was on the board of HIAS. Now, as we kind of look at this, and we kind of go, what the heck are they doing? They are deliberately, folks, they're waging warfare tactics. This is cultural warfare. It's economic warfare as well, because they're bringing people in to take your jobs and make you suffer. They're bringing people in to actually eat your pets and to actually change the form of government and the paradigms in where you live, because we reported this in Springfield. Folks, all of this and all these people that have been brought here have been brought here in violation of the Constitution. The federal government has no authority to be doing these resettlements or refugees. They don't have the authority anywhere in that Constitution to import persons. They only have the ability to exercise the natural form of, or I should say, a natural uniform, or actually a uniform rules and laws of naturalization, and manage the one-by-one immigration into America. Their job is, when people come here, they get here that are not supposed to be here, they are supposed to repel these invaders. Whether it's a small class of people, whether it is a large group of people, it doesn't matter. The Constitution demands that they be repelled. So why are they doing this, and what the heck is this we're seeing? We're seeing an exercising of warfare in all different forms against you and the states you live in. Whether it be subsidies to the farmers, where the farmers aren't growing any food, so that you can't buy your food local. You actually have to go, and hopefully we'll get something in from the foreign markets. They are setting us up to be able to kill lots of us very quickly, by starvation, by weather, by events, and or by combatants that they bring in. Anyway, let me dive into the next story so that we can kind of get into, you know, the next, I'll call it the next weather event. Because what we're talking about here, let me see, kind of lost my place. This is where we are. Was Hurricane Helen subject to weather modification and other curious questions? George Reese covers weather modification via NEXRAD, NEXRAD. Doppler Weather Radar Network Delayed Government Emergency Response reports that FEMA is confiscating supplies and giving them to migrants in sanctuary cities. a video of an unmarked black helicopter damaging supplies and radical FEMA employees prioritizing LGBTQIA people. Dane Wigington said that he had a conference call with the representatives and senators from the Carolinas and advised them of weather modification via manipulation of atmospheric pressure zones that affects hurricanes. He claims Hurricane Helene was not a natural weather event and claims this is weather warfare. In other words, people are starting to use this other language. And when we finish this, I'm going to get into some of the stuff that I've actually observed over the course of the past few weeks. And I should have noticed this sooner, but anyway, Hurricane Helene victims being denied $750 in assistance payments promised by Kamala. Locals who have had their lives turned upside down due to Hurricane Helene. Oh, by the way, the federal government doesn't have the authority to give anybody money or assistance. This needs to come from we the people. And I'll get into that. Well, I'll just dive into this really quick. There are people that live in areas where weather can have a very adverse effect with you, your life, and your property. If you live on the coast where, you know, hurricanes are kind of prominent. Now, I get that they have these, you know, unnatural hurricanes today. And we look at all the different weather. I get it. But when you live in an area like on the California coast, there are places on the California coast that when a real storm comes in or a tsunami or what have you from an earthquake, I don't know if they're causing earthquakes, but they may be. But when an earthquake shakes and there's the California coast and the coast around the Pacific Rim, all of the coasts are susceptible to a tsunami. So if you're living in an area that could be hit by a tsunami, you're paying extra for what we'll call insurance. And as a matter of fact, that insurance costs a lot of money. If you can't afford the insurance, but you still want to live there and you're willing to take that risk, then there are consequences to that behavior. We talk about this all the time. When there are consequences to behavior, we have to live with those consequences. But quickly, you know, when all of a sudden you have to live with the consequences, how many people are dying and swearing, oh, please remove this bitter cup from me. You know, I knew I shouldn't have been here. I mean, you knew being there, you had these risks. Now, it's one thing if all of a sudden, you know, you're in an area that is, you know, susceptible to, you know, tsunamis and what, you know, what we call storm surge, where, you know, the waves overtake and, you know, destroy your house, what have you. Okay. All right. So it's one thing if that happens, because you know that that's what you stand at risk from. But it's another thing if all of a sudden a tornado comes along, because that's not very common along the West Coast. And if, you know, a tornado started showing up, then that would be something a little bit different. But now that we've got government involved, we have to do something. We have to actually start, you know, taking the bull by the horns and holding them accountable. They should have none of this equipment. All this equipment needs to be basically shuttered. It needs to be basically dismantled and destroyed, because they have no authority to do this. Anyway, a woman who states that she is a former Coast Guard member who traveled to North Carolina with her canines for body recovery efforts was advised to avoid FEMA, as agents were reportedly confiscating supplies from private citizens. Additionally, members of the volunteer group she worked with discovered that FEMA was diverting supplies meant for North Carolina's to migrant shelters. In other words, here you come, you know, to help the people with these supplies. And we've seen that this has been just nothing but problematic. We've also been hearing that they've actually taken over large areas of land in North Carolina where the federal government is claiming that that's theirs. And we go through this, folks. They do not have the authority to possess any land other than those things that are enumerated in the Constitution. In other words, the seat of government in the District of Columbia, and then they have the ability to possess forts, shipyards, magazines, and arsenals. And so those are the four things or five things that they can possess, and needful buildings. Can they come in and take a, you know, mountaintop of people because it was, you know, destroyed by what? No, they don't have any authority for the environment, for trees, for spotted owls. They have no authority to protect an area or to come in and make claim. When we look at what happened in Nevada with the Bundys, when we look at what happened in Oregon with Lavoie Finicum, when we look at what's happened with, you know, all of these different situations where the government said, we want your land. This is happening throughout the flyover states, and you're not even aware of it because the local news throughout the major metropolises and the major outlets are not going to cover this. They are taking land, and they're taking more and more. And actually, what the BLM and the these federal agencies are doing is they're coming along and saying, well, we want you to kind of give us guidance on how you want us to use your property when we take it from you. Folks, this is how arrogant they are. We actually have a petition regarding the land, the use of land and the authority of land. So that's petition 21. And actually, those petitions, if they're not up by now, they will be up anytime soon. I got to go check, but if they're not up by now, they will be by sometime soon, tomorrow or sometime this week. This way, you can actually start pulling these petitions in. And all you need to do is just give us a call, send me an email, and we will actually give you the Word document for that petition so you can make the edits. When you look at the petition, you'll find there's a red text. The red text means that that's a county name. You need to change that county name to fit yours. You'll notice that there's a red name for the state. You need to change the red name so that it fits yours. If you're in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, then you just change the county, city, or what have you, and you just make the appropriate changes, and now you have a First Amendment petition that has been basically vetted and is a strong and irrefutable constitutional argument that you can actually start demanding your county commissioners get behind and start using these things as weapons at your state level to start taking on the federal government and holding the federal government accountable for all of these atrocities. This is why I keep talking about the need for a movement. I'm hoping when I talk to Matt Hawkins, we'll be able to dive into what he's doing with his campaign. And I plan on bringing up where he would be today had Semi Byrd actually decided to create a movement instead of doing the old financial or running the campaign the old financial way. In other words, being sold to all those people who have money so that they can basically buy favors with you. Wouldn't it be better to actually run a campaign based on a movement and based on the principles that they have no authority to do these things? This is why we need a movement to break the cycle of having politicians beholden to those who grant them money, because that's the only way you could have got elected. And I absolutely disbelieve that. So here's the thing, because I know Matt Hawkins is running a campaign financing for a state-run campaign. In other words, he's running for a state seat. He's running for the state auditor. And when we look at how much money he has brought in to date, when we talk about this, because I think the getting into these numbers is critical. And I want you to look at how many people voted for him. Let's just say that if Matt Hawkins has only $10,000 that he's brought into his campaign, and he had 100,000 votes. Now, it'll be a lot more than that. But if we just do the bare math, that's 10 to 1. In other words, for every dollar of vote, or every dollar of contributions he got 10 votes. That's pretty doggone good. That's a very good, solid campaign. But I'm telling you that a financial campaign is no way to run a campaign. You have to run your campaign on true principles as a movement. And this is why you can't wait to actually run a campaign on the time or at the point of filing. You don't let yourself sit there and wait and say, okay, I can't campaign until I go file and I've been authorized to run. No, you have every opportunity to start creating a PR campaign against those people who are in office today. How do you create that PR campaign? By using petitions and getting people to hold them accountable. There's no better PR campaign available than actually calling people out for violating their constitutional oath, for violating the Constitution, and bottom line, demanding that they step down and be removed. So if you do that for 2 or 4 years, however long you have to wait to run against that person again, or for the first time, because if you do it right after the election, you have at least 2 to 4 years, and 6 if you're running for U.S. Senate. But at that point, you now are launching a long-term campaign. So by the time the campaign actually starts, 6 months or however many months before the real general election, then at that point in time, when the real campaign, or I should say the official campaign starts, you have a pile of empirical data. You say, I petitioned this person for this purpose and this purpose and this purpose and this purpose, and list all of the things of the atrocities and how this person does not care about our liberties, nor do they care about their oath to the Constitution. And if you live in a red county, if you live in a red state, I'm here to tell you that the people in those counties and state are not going to be happy. As a matter of fact, they will support you and vote for you because you've done your due diligence and you've proven how this person should never be elected again. And then we can actually start enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The whole point of this movement is to actually obtain access, easy access, to removing public servants. So we have a pledge out there that basically identifies what that the process should be. When a person is petitioned and that petition proves how they have violated a good tangible proof of how the person is violated, not by based on whether the person will acknowledge it or not, but based on a basic constitutional compliance committee. I want you to understand this. The constitutional compliance committees that we're setting up at the county level, because where do you send this petition? You send this petition to your county commissioners. If this is a legislative district for your state, then that would be right there in your county. And so they will actually make the determination, the Constitutional Compliance Committee, then they'll send it off to the commissioners. The commissioners will then forward that petition, basically calling you out. You have violated it. In other words, it's been certified. The Constitutional Compliance Committee will certify that this is a legitimate petition that must move forward. Folks, in doing that, we're creating literally a connect the dots process of holding public servants accountable and getting rid of them. So I'm hoping that you're really starting to see that this is how we do this. And the brilliance of what the good Lord gave us is overwhelming. He knew what we needed and he gave it to us. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.